You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 295, Exodus 24, part 2. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing this week?
Pretty good. Can't complain.
Yeah, well, you're doing some traveling, aren't you?
I was in New York. I did the Eric Metaxas show. Lexum wanted me to go out there and do that, so we did that. And, you know, the Frequency Conference, which is, I believe, by the time this episode airs, I will actually be in Philadelphia for that. And then I'm going to have Fringe Pop filming right after that. Then we get ETS and SBL, you know, so it's creeping up on us.
Yeah, and of course, we just had our conference a couple of weeks ago. And Mike, I forgot to tell one story last week. I want to tell this week, but it was pretty cool that this is just more of a technology story. But as I'm monitoring...
Is it a horror story?
No, not really. But
that's good.
The audio was a little low for your presentation on the live stream only, and I'm monitoring social media just to see if I get any feedback or whatnot. And finally, somebody said, you know, turn it up a little bit. He was actually watching it from Ghana in Africa. So,
wow.
How crazy is that, that you can ask
in
the middle of Africa, hey, can you turn it up? And then you get it turned up, you know, in real time. How crazy is that? I love that story. So
that is, yeah, that is. Boy, it's not too long ago that would have just been an absurd thing to even think.
Yeah, I mean, wow. It's just amazing. Yeah, absolutely amazing. So if you didn't catch the live stream, I can't turn it up for you more because it's already happened, but you can at least go watch the replay. You know, so go to nakedbibleconference.com, go to live stream. You can get the information there on how to do that, Mike. And it was pretty fun, and still recovering from that, but
well, maybe, like, you know, maybe in our lifetimes it'll be, hey, can you put some salt on this, you know? We'll have, like, in Star Trek, the replicators, you know.
Oh, there you go. Nice.
Yeah,
all right, Mike, well,
that would be super crazy.
It would be.
That's Elon Musk crazy right there.
Hey, you know, they're trying to do those space trips or whatnot. If I had the money, I'd be up there in a heartbeat. So maybe we can get enough. Maybe we can do a show up there, Mike. Do a podcast from space.
Right. You
know, that'd be pretty cool.
Yeah.
The moon looking back, that would be something.
I'd need a lot of guinea pigs to go first before I'd even think about that. So
right.
And of course, a lot of money.
but right. But if it was reasonable enough, would you do it? If it was safe, you know, yeah. They proved it, whatnot. Would you do it?
Well, yeah. If they could convince me it was safe, yeah, I'd do it.
All right, there you go. Well, you heard it here, folks. We're going to do a podcast
space
as soon as they make it safe. We're up there. So. Yeah. Or our conference. We'll have a conference up there somehow.
Put that on your calendar, yeah.
Oh, it's on. Trust me, it's on. So if anybody works for NASA or Elon Musk or listens to the show, you know, Bezos, anybody, contact me because we are interested in doing a podcast from space.
Put us on the waiting list, yeah.
Please. All right, Mike. Well, back into second half of Exodus 24.
Yep, Exodus 24, verses 9 through 18. That's the end of the chapter. And like I said last time, we're going to focus mostly on the episode of verses 9 through 11. But let's just, to review a little bit of Exodus 24, let's just start there. You know, if you remember the last episode or just glancing at the chapter right now, in Exodus 24, it begins in the first couple of verses with God's invitation to Moses, Aaron, Nadav, Abihu, and 70 elders to ascend the mountain in order to worship. And, you know, the areas are divided. I mean, not everybody's allowed to occupy the same space, it's whatnot, but you know, at least they're there. At least there's an audience there. And it's part of the covenant ratification ceremony, which you get in verses 3 through 8. We talked about last time. So there was a ceremony with Israel involving the use of blood, spattering blood on the people, or maybe that means on the 12 pillars and whatnot. And we talked about the meaning of that. It sealed the covenant between God and Israel, and it prepared the people for God's presence, again, to celebrate his presence. And it also, in some way, was part of an ordination of them collectively as the kingdom of priests. So, you know, that's how the chapter opens. And after the sacrifices occur, and again, some of them are peace offerings, which involved, again, in Leviticus anyway, and we don't have Leviticus yet. We don't have the sacrificial system laid out. But when we do, we can look back at the peace offerings. And part of the procedure there was to eat part of the sacrifice. So it was like a communal meal. And so you've got that happening. And then you hit verses 9 through 11. Let me just read 9 through the rest of the chapter as we begin here. Then Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and the 70 elders of Israel went up, and they saw the God of Israel. There was under his feet, as it were, a pavement of sapphire stone, like the very heaven for clearness. And he did not lay his hand on the chief men of the people of Israel. They beheld God, and ate and drank. The Lord said to Moses, "Come up to me on the mountain and wait there, that I may give you the tablets of stone with the law and the commandment, which I have written for their instruction." So Moses rose with his assistant Joshua, and Moses went up into the mountain of God. And he said to the elders, "Wait here for us until we return to you. And behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. Whoever has a dispute, let him go to them." Then Moses went up on the mountain, and the cloud covered the mountain. The glory of the Lord dwelt on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And on the seventh day he called out to Moses in the midst of the cloud. Now the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a devouring fire on the top of the mountain in the sight of the people of God. Moses entered the cloud and went up on the mountain, and Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. That's the rest of Exodus 24. So, again, we're going to focus on the meal. They saw the God of Israel and had a meal there. But let's just start with the general issue of seeing Yahweh. Now, Exodus 33:20, let me read that to you. "But he said, 'You cannot see my face,'" Hebrew is panim there, "'for man shall not see me and live.'" This is God speaking to Moses. When Moses asks if he can, you know, see God, that's God's answer. So Exodus 33:20 seems to suggest that what we read in Exodus 24:9 through 11 couldn't happen. So we have an issue, again, that's been talked about numerous times in scholarship. And of course, anybody who's, you know, reading the passage and thinking about it and discussing it with friends, you know, you're going to run across this seeming contradiction. Now, in the I put something in the protected folder. This is Bernard Robinson's article, "The Theophany and Meal of Exodus 24. It's from the Scandinavian Journal of the Old Testament. This is from 2011. Now, Robinson, again, is discussing this passage, and he gives examples of commentators who are so startled by the scene, again, because of Exodus 33. You know, when they read 9 through 11, it's like, well, how in the world could that even happen? That just doesn't work. Commentators who are so startled by that they actually recommend changing the text under the presumption that what's in the traditional text, the Masoretic text, must be the result of variants found elsewhere. Like it couldn't really have originally said that, because that just can't happen. Now, other scholars, and again, if you had access to journals, you would find these Nicholson, I guess, 3 articles on this chapter. They don't buy that. They refute this idea. Look, the text says what it says. There's no need to say that it originally said something else just to get us out of this problem. So we're not going to change the text. Now, you can tell, though, in fairness, you can tell that the Septuagint translator seemed a little uncomfortable with the idea of seeing Yahweh because of the way he translates this. Now, I'm going to read a little bit from Carpenter's commentary here. He writes this: "The Septuagint translator found it too bold and says this. Instead of 'they saw the God of Israel,' here's what the Septuagint says: 'They saw the place where he stood there, the God of Israel.'" And Carpenter continues, you know, this is what it says, and proceeds, the Septuagint proceeds to describe the appearance of the place under God's feet. But the Masoretic text has God as the object of ra'ah, the object of seeing, even though what they see is God's feet. Now, the implication is clear. They could not and did not look on God himself, that is, his face. His throne floor is described, but he is not. No human could look at his face and live, Exodus 33:20. Theophanies were traumatic and dangerous to those who experienced them. Genesis 16, Genesis 28, Genesis 32, Judges 6, so on. Other commentators, however, believe that these privileged persons saw God in his glory, but exceptionally lived to tell about it. They didn't die. That's the end of the Carpenter quote. Now, you know, what Carpenter's saying here is even in antiquity, Septuagint translator, you can tell they were uncomfortable about this notion of seeing God. And so they translate it in such a way where they just see the spot where God was. And then they go on, okay, they're looking at his feet and so on and so forth. But the pushback by Carpenter and others is like, look, you know, even if you take the MT for what it is, they saw the God of Israel. It doesn't specifically say they saw his panim, his face. There's another way you can take face, and I often get this question either at conferences or I think we've done it in Q&A as well. I think the point is that you can't see the direct presence of God unveiled, like his direct presence. I would take panim to refer to the unveiled presence, because then you would die. And the reason I do that and don't just isolate it to his face is because of passages like Genesis 18, where God shows up as a man. And the angel, who has conversations, we're not told that the angel was like turned another way or the person's got his face to the ground. Or, I mean, there are people who have conversations with the angel of the Lord or the captain of the Lord's host, you know, Joshua 5. And it doesn't say they weren't looking at him. It doesn't say that they couldn't see his face. It doesn't say any of that. So I think we have to assume when we're not told that they're having a conversation with a figure they believe is a man, but more than a man. And that's okay. They're allowed to do that. And so that's why I take the prohibition of Exodus 33, that no man can look upon, you know, my panim and live. Okay. I think that's really the point. The unveiled, unfiltered presence of God, the glory itself. It's hard to even know how to talk about it. But there's a way that if you looked upon God, you would die. And there are ways that you can look at God and not die. I mean, that much is clear. It's just how to parse all that. Now, it's interesting when God sort of honors Moses' request, Moses is allowed to see his back parts. And in that case, he doesn't see the face, but we're not actually told. I mean, there's anthropomorphic language used in Exodus 33, Exodus 34. And so you could argue, well, isn't that the angel? And why can't they talk face to face if it's the angel? Well, it never says that. It does use anthropomorphic language. But again, I think that what Moses is allowed to gaze upon is in human form and is not, again, the unveiled presence, the unveiled glory of God. So that's why I take that interpretive trajectory as opposed to, well, the issue is just the face. Okay. So I'm going to disagree a little bit with Carpenter, but the general idea is the same. I don't think that we need to change the Masoretic text because Exodus 24 just says they saw the God of Israel. And then it zeroes in on the feet. It doesn't say they saw the panim. So this passage can work with the other passages in at least two possible ways, the face or the unveiled presence. So I think it's an overreaction on the part of whoever, you know, these commentators, you know, happen to be, you know, that, well, we need to change the text. I think that's a little odd. I also think it's an overreaction on the part of the Septuagint translator. But again, it's easy to judge him because he's dead, you know, but I'll say that. I think it is an overreaction. Now, Robinson, in his article, cites the famous Jewish commentator Umberto Casuto for a rebuttal to the timid Septuagint translator. I thought this was kind of interesting. Robinson writes this. He says, Casuto points out that while the expression in Exodus 24:11 is uncommonly corporeal in talking in the active voice about seeing God, the use of the verb ra'ah, to see, in the passive, that God or his glory was seen or appeared, for example, Exodus 16:7, Exodus 24:17, that expression is commonplace. So let me just stop there. Casuto points out that, yeah, it's pretty unusual to have the verb ra'ah, to see, in the active voice, and then the direct object be God. That's unusual. But he said it's not unusual to have the passive and say that God was seen or God appeared. That's pretty common. So Casuto is pushing back here and saying, well, I don't know why the Septuagint translator was so timid here. Maybe the Septuagint translator didn't realize that this same verb used passively of God is pretty common, but he doesn't need to freak out. So it's Casuto's little pushback to the Septuagint guy. Now, back to the Robinson quote about Casuto and his work. He says, "This fact causes one perhaps to wonder whether there can be much difference between saying that someone sees God and saying that God appears or is seen by someone. You know, is there really any difference? Is that a distinction without a difference?" Robinson says, "Talk of seeing God is a bold usage, but it needs no emending nor explaining away, despite the existence of texts which express the view that it is impossible or nigh impossible to see God without dying." Then he has a footnote. Robinson has a footnote at the end of that portion that says this. His examples are, of course, Exodus 33:20, you know, the thing about dying. But the footnote adds, "In Genesis 16:13, Hagar marvels that she has been able to see God and live. In Genesis 32:30, Masoretic text verse 31, Jacob says with amazement, "I have seen Elohim, I have seen Elohim, God, face to face, and my life is preserved." In Judges 6:23, after Gideon has seen the angel of Yahweh, Yahweh has to reassure him that he will not die. And in Judges 13:22, Manoah, after seeing the angel of Yahweh, says, "We shall surely die, for we have seen Elohim." And his wife reassures him in verse 23 that if Yahweh had meant to kill them, he would not have accepted offerings from their hands, and they'd already be dead not having this conversation. So, you know, the footnote, I think, is well taken, that there are exceptions to this. And again, the way I parse that is this idea of the unveiled presence. That is what's going to fry you. Not God in human form, because Jacob wrestles with the angel, who is Elohim. Abraham has a meal with Yahweh as a man. I mean, and again, there's no hint in these passages that, you know, they're either having the wrestling match or serving the meal, and they're not looking at the face. The text never says that. It would sort of be, if we're supposed to think that, the writer would put it in. Otherwise, it's really an abnormal thought. Okay. Now, let's go back again, verses 9 through 11. That's our general consideration of the whole topic of seeing God. So we actually go back to the verses. It says very plainly, "They saw the God of Israel." And then 7 verses later, God tells Moses to come up to me on the mountain and wait there, that I may give you the tablets of stone. So an obvious question surfaces. We had this last time as well. Where is God when they see him? Now, you know, we have to assume either that Moses is still on the mountain with the group back in the beginning of Exodus 24. So we have to either assume that, and then Moses goes up further. There might be a problem with that. We'll hit on it in a minute or so. We might also assume that they went down the mountain, and that's where Moses tells everybody, "Hey, you wait here. I got to go back up and get the tablets." Maybe that happened. Again, we have to make some assumptions here, just like we did earlier. In part one, with Exodus 24:1-2, where God says, "Hey, come up here." And if you go back to Exodus 20, Moses, in theory, was already up there. So somewhere, Moses has a descent and then he has to go back up. That's possible. We're just not told every detail. And, you know, the text doesn't intend to tell us every detail. He turned right. He looked over here. He went up, took this many steps. There are lots of details we don't get. So we don't need to obsess about that. Anyway, this is the instruction. And we have to wonder, okay, where's Moses, where's God when they see him? What is actually happening here? Where's God's location? Now, Robinson goes through a number of proposals offered in scholarly literature. And the three most interesting are these. I'm going to give you the three that I find, again, you know, worth mentioning here. So the first one, and this is just my summary here. The first option is that there are scholars who say, well, God's in heaven, with his feet touching the sky firmament, okay, the dome over the earth in Israelite cosmology, that the Israelites can see and in part see through. Now, this idea is defended by noting the phrase, quote, "like heaven for clearness." Let me just read you the text. "Then Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and the 70 elders of Israel went up, and they saw the God of Israel. There was under his feet, as it were, a pavement of sapphire stone, like the very heaven for clearness." All right? That's verses 9 and 10. So, again, one school of thought is that we have God is in heaven somewhere in the stratosphere or whatever, you know, to use modern terminology, and his feet are resting on this dome, and that's what they see. And the dome is made of sapphire stone, which is lapis lazuli. And that the term that's used here in Exodus 24 is the same, you know, Hebrew term, a description drawn from like Ezekiel 1:26 and Ezekiel 10:1. Ezekiel 1:26, this is the throne of the cherubim, the cherubim throne. Part of that description is, above the expanse over their heads, the cherubim's heads, there was the likeness of a throne in appearance like sapphire, and seated above the likeness of a throne was a likeness with a human appearance. So there's some sort of platform or thing. And if you go back to our episode on Ezekiel 1 in the Ezekiel series, you know, I will talk about how the language there is astronomical. Again, that's probably the point, four cardinal points of the zodiac. And so this would be kind of the dome. You know, that would be the platform. So you may have a connection there, because Ezekiel has astronomical meaning, and a much bigger picture, if you pardon the pun there. And the same language is used here in Exodus 24. You could also look at Isaiah 66:1. Thus says the Lord, heaven is my throne, the earth is my footstool, and what is the house that you would build for me, and what is the place of my rest? Okay. Now Robinson adds a note of interest here along with this first view. He says, lapis lazuli is a rock of varying composition, sometimes opaque, sometimes translucent. Probably the latter is envisaged here, and la tahor, translated clearness, means that the pavement was so bright that it dazzled the 74, making their sight of the deity even more indirect. Okay, you take that for what it's worth. But the first option is, you know, if we ask, well, where's God in the scene? He's in heaven and his feet are like on the firmament, and they look up and they can see through it and they see the feet of God. That's the view, that this is what they're actually looking at when it says they saw the God of Israel. Second option is kind of similar, a little bit, at least conceptually. This is the idea that God is in heaven, again, and the summit of the mountain reaches up into heaven. This has God closer than the first view. You know, because if it's the firmament, God's way, way up there, okay? So this has God closer than the first view. In this regard, Robinson writes, quote, Mesopotamian ziggurats were said to rest on the earth while their summit reached up to heaven. Their upper story contained a sanctuary, sometimes paved with lapis lazuli, that served as a habitation for the gods. Sacrificial meals with a small number of human participants seemingly took place there, at least at New Year, unquote. So again, he's talking about Babylonian stuff. But, you know, a lot of scholars don't opt for this because if this is the case, the command in Exodus 24:12 doesn't make a whole lot of sense. The Lord said to Moses, come up to me on the mountain and wait there, that I may give you the tablets of stone with the law and the commandment which I have written for their instruction. You know, if the mountain's supposed to be at the very top, you know, like reaching into the heavens, like literally, well, Moses has a long trip to make. And I mean, is this really what's going on? You know, and how are we to exaggerate the language so that we can get the mountain to be like a ziggurat and actually up into the heavens? And so for this reason, there are less people that take this, but, you know, you get the representation because of the Mesopotamian parallel, and more people who would take the first one just because of the for clearness language and the language of Ezekiel. Third option is that Yahweh has come to earth. And the humans in this passage are in proximity to him in some extent, to some extent, but they see, or at least look at, only his feet. And, you know, honestly, that would be kind of similar to Ezekiel 1 as well, because the prophet, you could argue the prophet is there by the river Kivar. Maybe it's a vision, but maybe it's something that descends, because the throne chariot, quote unquote, you know, descends to earth, you know, and sets down. You know, so again, the third view is in the realm of possibility anyway. Now, all three of these are worth consideration, in my view, for different reasons. The text doesn't decisively rule any of them out. I think some are more likely than others, but the text doesn't, like, kill any of them immediately. The first option is interesting, again, because of the wording, as we mentioned, you know, like the working of sapphire, you know, stones, but this is more literally, just to make it more literal, that the, let me just go back to verse 10. There was under his feet, as it were, a pavement, okay? There was under his feet, as it were, something like the working of sapphire tiling and like the substance of the heavens for clearness. That's a little bit more literal. substance of the heavens, you actually get this phrase, etzem hashamayim, substance of the heavens may suggest the firmament, like the firmament's actually made of something in Israelite cosmology. However, the glory is said to be on the mountain later, not above the firmament. So again, you have problems here. Yeah, so what are we going to do with that? So in verses 16 to 17, we get the glory on the mountain and not on the firmament. You know, I like the firmament view. I think you can tell, but there is this point of disconnection. So, you know, who knows? Moses also has to enter the cloud to meet with God later on in the chapter. Well, how are you going to do that? Does Moses go through the firmament? Or, you know, like what's going on here? So there are, as much as I like this and as much as some of the phrasing sort of suggests it, there are problems with it, again, that make me a little bit hesitant. But again, I kind of like it, but I'm not saying it's exactly workable either. On the other side, can't we just take the cloud there, not as the clouds like in the heavens? Can we just take the cloud as a cloud that appears on earth? Because elsewhere that happens. You know, when Moses meets with God in the cloud descends like over the Holy of Holies or something like that. Maybe you got something like that happening here early, even before we get the tabernacle. So the cloud sort of comes with Yahweh to veil the glory of Yahweh as Israel moves about its day-to-day, you know, work. And of course, on the way to the promised land. Maybe that's what we have going on here. You know, the honest answer is they're all three sort of workable, but also not workable. I mean, they all three have problems. In any event, all we can know for sure is that in Exodus 24, 9 through 11, God is seen as a man. He has feet, okay? He's seen as a man from whatever vantage point we have. Again, take the view that you like, but realize that all of them have some obstacles to overcome. I see no reason, the third view, that God has actually come to earth. I see no reason why that view can't be given equal weight. Scholars, in my view, are too married to JEDP thinking to allow for number three. I mean, this is the resistance you get to the third one, that you have God actually come to earth as a man. You'll see a lot of discussion in scholarly literature about anti-anthropomorphism in later Hebrew literature, like JEDP. I mean, that's a chronological set of documents in that theory. So they say, well, you know, we can't have that. You know, P doesn't like anthropomorphisms, and neither does you know, E, and E sounds like P here, and blah, 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 blah. So they rule out the anthropomorphic idea just because they're married to the theory. Well, I'm not married to the theory. And I think, you know, in the ancient Near Eastern world, you get plenty of anthropomorphic language used of deities. So I don't really know what the problem is other than the theory. And the theory seems to be what's getting in the way. So Robinson comments here, and there's a little slight pushback in here to the JEDP in his quote. He says, why does the text have they saw the God of Israel rather than they saw Yahweh? If we're to move beyond saying that the phrase shows the hand of E, or more likely P, how are we to read the phrase? Casuto thinks the sentence is worded with care in order to minimize anthropomorphism. Then he quotes Casuto. It is not stated they saw Yahweh using the name that belongs specifically and exclusively to the Lord all-glorious himself, but only they saw God, the God of Israel, employing the generic appellation that denotes divine phenomena, unquote of Casuto. So then Robinson continues, and he says, Casuto notes that in Isaiah 6, the use of the tetragrammaton is again avoided. If you read Isaiah 6, you don't see Yahweh, you see Adonai, okay? And so Casuto notes this to try to sort of prop up this idea. But then Robinson writes, although, however, the tetragrammaton, the divine name, is placed on the lips of the seraphs in Isaiah 6. They don't have any trouble saying it, and the writer doesn't have any trouble putting it in there, on the lips of the seraphs, in verse 3, and on the prophet's lips, in verse 5, which Casuto omits to mention. Casuto doesn't mention that. He either misses it or forgets it or doesn't want to bring it up because it messes with his own idea. Robinson writes, I think he may be right to think that the avoidance of the tetragrammaton in our present verse here in Exodus 24 may well have been the sort of theological significance that he posits. What the human visitors see is Yahweh anyway, but the text is coy about spelling that out too explicitly. So he's like, well, maybe he's kind of right, but does it really matter? You know, is it a distinction without a difference is the point. Now, back to me, I think the resistance, again, to anthropomorphism, as I alluded to earlier, just because you're married to the JEDP theory, is a classic instance of filtering the text through a presumed religious evolution. Now, I wrote an SBL regional paper on this, on anthropomorphisms in P. So they're not supposed to be there, but guess what? They are. They are, in fact, there. In literature, everyone in the scholarly world assigns to P. Again, if you're married to JEDP, everybody agrees that the stuff I use in my paper is P. But yet, lo and behold, there's anthropomorphisms. If you're interested in that, I'm not going to rabbit trail here on it. You can get that paper in a Kindle version on Amazon. It's one of those papers I published in Kindle form a long time ago. But again, I just think this is a classic instance of filtering the scriptures through a theory. So I don't see any reason why we can't read Exodus 24 as God coming to earth. Even though I like the firmament view because of the language, it has problems. The second view, I think, is the least likely. And the third view, God actually has come to earth as a man. That's well on the table. I just don't see any obstacle to that. I would also say that if you're going to try to deny that it's actually Yahweh come to earth because it's late, and then you're going to argue something against it, because of this presumed evolution, this presumed chronology, it would also be kind of odd, because the description of what they see, the feet on the, you know, the lapis lazuli, that has a parallel in the Baal epic that everybody knows. It's in the description of Baal's house. And Ugaritic literature is not late. It's early. It's well before E and P. Okay, so that would make it even more odd. Again, Exodus 24:10 says, there was under his feet, as it were, the pavement of sapphire stone, like the very heaven for clearness. Baal's house is built of bricks, and it's the same term, LBNT, as you get the word for pavement in Exodus 24. It's also built of sapphire stones, lapis lazuli. This is what Baal's house is built out of. The same terminology here. El, of course, also holds banquets in his house. Again, so why you get this anthropomorphic language in early literature? Ugaritic is early. So why can't we see it in Israelite stuff? Well, because of the theory. The theory says we shouldn't. Well, sorry, I don't really care about the theory. The Baal cycle is much older, again, than where the critics want to put E and P, and I think we need to think just better about this. So again, for me, God coming to earth in Exodus 24 is actually on the table. Now, one interesting difference, since we just rabbit trailed to Baal stuff a little bit, one interesting difference between the Ugaritic stuff and that of the Hebrew Bible in these like divine banquets, these scenes, okay, at Baal's house or El's house or whatever, is that in the divine banquets in the Ugaritic text, there are no human participants ever. Humans do not belong in the presence of the gods at all. But in the Hebrew Bible, they do. Again, I think that's a telling contrast between the literature. So we talk a lot about comparison. Sometimes the contrasts are pretty significant, and I say that one is really significant. Now, in verse 11, we get the sentence, they beheld God, and they ate, and they drank. All the verbs here are third-person plural. And it takes us into the meal. Now, we don't have God eating, okay? The nearest antecedent here are the people, the chief men of the people of Israel. You know, Moses, Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, the 70 elders. They're the ones who are eating and drinking, and that's indicated by the plural verbs. It's not God. They're just looking at God, and then they eat and drink. You know, they have a meal, at least in God's presence, but God isn't said to be grabbing a fork and chomping down himself. Okay, that's the only point we're trying to make with that particular observation. Now, let's talk about the meal a little bit. You know, you get other passages, though, that argue pretty strongly for a real meal that God does participate in. That's Genesis 18. That's the most obvious example. When you read Genesis 18, let's just go to, I mean, you're familiar with the story. God, Yahweh and two angels show up, and they look like three men. They show up where Abraham's at, and they're going to have a meal. In verse 8, it says this, just Genesis 18:8. Then he took curds and milk, this is Abraham, and the calf that he had prepared, and he set it before them. And he stood by them under the tree while they ate. Now, some people try to argue that the one standing by is Yahweh. That's just really a misreading. He stood by them. Okay, he, the nearest antecedent, and then this is grammar, is Abraham. It's very obvious. And they ate. Okay, so there are passages where this does happen, where God does participate. You get a few sacrificial references that seem to have God kind of like enjoying the smell of the sacrifice and whatnot. So you get some of that language too, but Genesis 18 is probably the strongest precedent for God participating in a meal directly. But in Exodus 24, again, to be consistent, to be fair here, you don't actually get that language. It's important to note that the meal itself, you know, rather than fixate on the question like, well, is God grabbing a fork or not? You know, this is the kind of thing I guess that scholars like to fixate on. I would suggest that it's more important to note that this meal is not what certifies the covenant between Yahweh and Israel. That has already been done via the blood ceremony, verses 3 and verse 8. The meal is a celebration of God's presence. Again, we talked about that in the last episode, peace offerings and whatnot. When we talked about Amy Peeler's work. Now, Robinson writes this in conjunction with what we're talking about. He said, it is by no means clear that what happens in verses 9 through 11 is a covenant-making ceremony. That's not the ceremony. Meals sealing a covenant are, it is true, narrated in Genesis 26, 26 through 30, and Genesis 31, 43 through 50. But a reading of verses 9 through 11 is speaking of a covenant-making ceremony, or as speaking of a covenant-making ceremony, based as it largely is on the phrase, quote, they ate and drank, unquote, is very vulnerable to criticism. And then in his article, he feels free to criticize it, and he does. And then he quotes Nicholson here. He says that a meal eaten in the presence of God was not ipso facto a covenant meal may be seen from a glance at the narrative in Exodus 18, 1 through 12. The passage seems to describe nothing more than an act of worship, of which the eating of a meal before God was part and a means of rejoicing in the presence of God. The activity of eating and drinking before God is mentioned elsewhere in the Old Testament in context which cannot be understood in terms of covenant ratification. Exodus 32:6, Deuteronomy 12:7, Deuteronomy 14:26, and so on and so forth. Had the tradition spoke of Yahweh as himself eating with Moses and the others, the case would have been different. For we could then have readily taken it as representing the deity as calling his human visitors into a covenantal bond with himself. That's the end of the Robinson quote. But of course, it doesn't say that. The covenant has already been ratified, blood, you know, sprinkled or spattered, you know, among the people or on the 12 pillars, whatever. The meal is a celebration of something that's already taken place. Now, last note on 24. 13 and 14. Let's just read that passage again. This is Exodus 24, 13 and 14. So Moses rose with his assistant Joshua, and Moses went up into the mountain of God. And he said to the elders, wait here for us until we return to you. And behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. Whoever has a dispute, let him go to them. Now, again, we have to presume Moses left the mountain after the theophany meal. And now he's going to go back up. This time he takes Joshua with him. His presence, Joshua's presence, will be important in terms of the leadership transition and consistency with the divine encounter motif common to spokespeople for God, what we would think of as prophets. It's all a prophet is, a spokesperson for God. I spent a whole chapter on this in Unseen Realm, this chapter 27, Standing in the Council, for this idea. So I'm going to quote a little bit from Unseen Realm here, because Joshua, he is validated as leader because he does have divine encounter. That's what marks a prophet. Someone who speaks for God, there's a divine counter motif that goes from Adam all the way up to the New Testament, you know, to Jesus, to the apostles, and you know, honestly, in some respects, to us as believers, because we have the Spirit. So this is a running motif throughout the entirety of Scripture. And so with respect to Joshua, here's a little bit of what I wrote in Unseen Realm. The implication is clear. The people need to listen and will listen to the person who is validated by an encounter with the presence of God. Divine encounter was also what initially validated Joshua as a prophet. In Exodus 24:13, just before the description of how Moses and the elders of Israel shared a meal, with Yahweh on Sinai, should say just after. We read, "So Moses rose with his assistant Joshua, and Moses went up to the mount, into the mountain of God." The verse implies that Joshua went along with Moses to see God. I mean, that he goes somewhere. He sees something. Exodus 33, 9 through 11 makes Joshua's contact with Yahweh a bit clearer. So if we read Exodus 33 a little bit later, this is what we encounter. "When Moses entered the tent," this is a different scene. He's not on the mountain anymore. He enters the tent. "When Moses entered the tent, the pillar of cloud would descend and stand at the entrance of the tent, and the Lord would speak with Moses. And when all the people saw the pillar of God standing at the entrance of the tent, all the people would rise up and worship, each at his tent door. Thus the Lord used to speak to Moses face to face, just as a man speaks to his friend. When Moses turned again into the camp, his assistant Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, would not depart from the tent." So apparently, the implication is that in some cases, Joshua was there too. It's kind of interesting, again, and this is going to help validate Joshua's leadership position, because Joshua goes with Moses up into the mountain. We're not told exactly where. Did he go all the way with Moses? You know, we're not told the details, but he's there. He's going to hear the voice. He's going to see something happen. And then we get this reference in Exodus 33. In Deuteronomy 31, 14 through 23, Yahweh specifically commands Moses to bring Joshua to the tent of meeting, where God himself commissioned Joshua to replace Moses. So again, this is the beginning of sort of singling Joshua out, you know, marking him as significant. One last note about the thematic continuity of what we'll loosely call divine banquets, because that's what's happening here with Exodus 24, 9 through 11. And honestly, this would take us an entire episode to unpack, but I'm just going to trace the thought. I'm just going to sketch this. Robinson's comments, again, are a good place to start. Now, just listen to this. "Although the scene in verses 9 through 11 is not expressly set in the heavenly sanctuary," again, we don't really know what it kind of looks like here. "Although that language is not used, Robinson says, else we should perhaps find some references to seraphim, as in Isaiah, or cherubim or something. There are clear signs here of temple imagery, which serve to point forward to the construction of the tabernacle. We have noted evidence for lapis lazuli being used in the construction of temples in the ancient Near East." Robinson does that in his article. And Baal's house, again, gets that reference. So there's evidence for lapis lazuli being used in the construction of temples in the ancient Near East, and that in Israel, a cultic theophany was part of temple life. You know, God does show up at the tabernacle. Again, Robinson writes, "Feasting was associated not just with pagan temples," and we've remarked earlier on Ugaritic evidence for this, "but also with the Jerusalem temple." Do we realize this? Let me break in here. Do we realize this? Eating and drinking, feasting, is associated with the temple. And, you know, again, and the tabernacle. So he ferrets out a few passages here. "Eating and drinking," this is Robinson again, "in the temple with joy before Yahweh is described or prescribed in Deuteronomy 12, 4 through 7, Deuteronomy 12, let's just go 1 through 7, and verses 15 through 18. "Feasting within the temple is probably envisaged by Psalm 36, 8, which says, 'They feast on the abundance of your house, and you give them drink from the river of your delights.'" Again, that may not be just metaphorical, because the temple did have a water source, and they could have food there, again, because they did that back in Deuteronomy with the tabernacle. "They are filled," again, "with the rich and plenty of your house." Psalm 65, 4 is another reference to being sated, being satisfied with the goodness of thy house. Again, they're just references like this that could be taken as food based upon what happens earlier in Deuteronomy in relationship to the tabernacle. And so Robinson is suggesting here, you know, some parts of this scene seem to foreshadow or at least parallel temple talk. And, you know, we need to pay attention to that. It is also significant, and this is me now, that Exodus 24, has earlier connections, namely Genesis 18, you know, with this idea of God sharing a meal with his people. You can even go back to Genesis. You can even go back to Eden for that. Eden, of course, is the garden of sustenance. There's no reason to think that God didn't show up at mealtime. I'll let Adam and Eve have a meal now. I don't want to bother them. No, I mean, they're in God's house. They're in his abode. And in his abode, in his house, which is Eden, there's abundance. There's lots to eat, enough to eat. You know, there's water. It's a paradise. And so you take this sort of connection between, you know, eating and drinking and having enough and being, you know, satisfied and the abundance there of the things that you need for life. That's in God's house in Genesis. So is it really unusual that we see feasting elsewhere in Genesis 18, in Exodus 24, in Deuteronomy 12? I mean, is this unusual? And the answer would be, well, no, I guess not. It's kind of a continuing idea. Also, the same language used of Passover in conjunction with the temple. Again, Passover is a communal meal in Deuteronomy 16. It's not in Exodus 12. We've talked about this before with differences about the Passover between Exodus 12 and Deuteronomy 16. In Deuteronomy 16, it's a communal meal with the Lord, you know, at the place where he has put his name, i.e. the temple, okay? Again, that's significant. Given the strong possibility, now here's the connection that you've probably been waiting for. The connection of this language, you know, communal meal with Passover is significant given the strong possibility that the Last Supper was a Passover meal. Now, I put in the folder two articles. This is the protected folder. You get access to the protected folder if you subscribe to the McLaught newsletter. The articles are Robin Routledge, Passover and the Last Supper. That's from the Tyndale Bulletin, 2002. And Joel Marcus, Passover and Last Supper Revisited. That's in New Testament Studies in 2013. So it's more recent. Both of these articles establish connections between Passover and the Last Supper. And, you know, that, again, if you take those connections and just insert them or give them their place in this idea of a communal meal with Exodus 24 and Deuteronomy and Genesis, okay, you get the idea. We have connections between Exodus 24 and the temple and the new covenant. Of course, the Lord's Supper, which commemorates the new covenant work of Jesus. The Lord's Supper language occurs in other places like the road to Emmaus. Okay, you get Lord's Supper language there in that episode. The culmination of this motif for the New Testament would be the marriage supper of the Lamb. It's juxtaposed with the devouring of God's enemies and the day of the Lord in Armageddon and the subsequent return to Eden. Eden returns to earth and we have a global Eden. In Second Temple and Rabbinic Judaism, the great eschatological feast included a meal of Leviathan. Guess what's on the menu? It's Leviathan. In other words, the devouring of chaos. It's metaphorical language for the consumption, the devouring, the end of chaos. Hence, in Revelation 21:3, there is no more sea. And therefore, there's no more Leviathan either. And chaos is done. The point of Revelation 21:3 isn't, oh, I guess there's no like salt water in the new earth. No. No, we're not blind literalists. Okay, we appreciate the metaphor for what the metaphor means throughout the course of the Old Testament. Leviathan is a chaos metaphor, one of the most frequent, and so is the sea because those two things are connected. Leviathan lives in the sea. It's also why the underworld is described in the same ways, okay? It's a chaos metaphor. And so when John in Revelation says there ain't no more sea, it means there's no more chaos. And chaos is anti-Eden. It is the term that scholars would use to describe everything and anything that runs contrary to the way God wants things. There's no more of that when you get to the Revelation 21 and 22. And so this communal meal idea is actually part of that picture too. Marriage, supper of the Lamb, you know, juxtaposed again in conjunction with the day of the Lord, and then, you know, the descent of, you know, the temple, all this stuff. It's all part of the same matrix of ideas. And I just think it's kind of interesting that here you go with Exodus 24. What are they doing? They're ratifying the covenant, the law. And you know, they do this with Passover. You know, they celebrate God's presence. And you connect that again to the Lord's Supper and, you know, to some of these other things. It makes sense. Why? Because what God wants is the restoration of his family. Families eat together at home. It's not complicated. It's profound, but it's not complicated. And Exodus 24, again, is part of that. So the point is that Exodus 24, 9 through 11 has a history, and it is a type. This is typology. A type is a nonverbal prophecy, an event that foreshadows something yet to come. And in this case, it foreshadows various things to come that the New Testament will, of course, unpack and unfold in its description of the eschatological day of the Lord and the marriage supper of the Lamb.
All right, Mike, which brings us to our assignment for next week's podcast. Do you know what that is?
Yeah, we're going to spend a whole episode on the Ark of the Covenant.
Right, so their homework assignment is...
part of Exodus 25.
Right, and their homework assignment is... Watch Raiders
Read of the Lost section Ark. Of the Ark of the Covenant.
No.
Yeah, Watch Raiders,
watch of, Raiders of the Lost Ark.
You would go to the more entertaining one.
We've got the face melting scripture part coming up, right?
Right. Yeah, there
right.
it's
right.
You can learn a lot of good biblical theology from
right. Raiders Indiana of the Lost Jones. Ark. You got face melting scripture coming up. I mean, the homework assignment is for everybody to watch it.
And I'll wear my jacket.
Yeah, well, you've got
this video.
Please tell me you're going to
get into the spirit of it.
Please tell me you're going to wear your jacket while we record that episode. At least put it on.
All right.
Okay.
We'll do it.
All right. Awesome.
Yep.
All right, Mike. We'll be looking forward to
play the music in the background too.
I want Greena to take a picture of you with the jacket on while you're recording the podcast, and we'll put it out there.
Okay.
On social media. That'd be perfect. All right, Mike. We appreciate it. All right. With that, I want to thank everybody else for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.